This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
How well are you going to do in the community? And we're in direct contact with the probation and parole officers, and we need to report whether or not they actually are involved in treatment and getting it.
And which counties are you working with?
Right now, we work mostly with Clackamas County and Multnomah County. Every once in a while, we might work with someone in Washington County. And in addition to the probation and parole, some from Oregon State Hospital, it really depends. They could be convicted of a sexual offense. There's many who are guilty but insane.
And what do you mean their recidivism rate goes down?
The baseline of reoffense for sexual offenders is lower than other crimes. It's actually much lower than I think people realize. And it depends on the type of offense that occurs. But with treatment, say you start with a 10% reoffense rate, that 10% can be cut down by 40% with treatment. I'm speaking right now with research I know about adult offenders.
So, Johnine Mano, talk about whole systems approach.
The whole systems approach was the design of the program to begin with, and that comes a little bit from my background in working in nonprofits that involved the family voice in mental health treatment, as well as one of my master's degrees in a systems theory or interdisciplinary type of approach to helping people. And that means the community getting involved as much as possible in the treatment of people who have been affected by sexual abuse, including the actual offender. So a whole system standpoint means that imagine everyone who's been impacted by sexual abuse, not just the families, the victims, if they want to be involved. As I said, churches, schools, some of the offenders are still in high school, neighborhood associations, sometimes neighbors. And so what we do is by working with the entire system for those who want to be involved, and we actually provide trainings, that speaks directly to the research that shows the more support networks that can be established and remain intact during treatment and especially after treatment, then the reoffense rate can remain at a lower percentage.
And Johnine, define sex offender and talk about the different types of sex offense and the degrees of sex offense.
Well, when I talk about this, I usually talk about a continuum of sexual offending behavior. And we really try hard not to call clients sex offenders because that implies that they're offending at the time we're seeing them.
And what do you call them?
So we call them people who've been convicted of a sexual offense. So they've got a criminal history in that regard. And so that could run the gamut of someone who was 17 when they're in high school. They had a 16-year-old girlfriend. They turn 18, they're still in high school, and they're convicted of a sexual offense, which may be what's called Rape 3 today. And the laws are always changing, so the actual name of the conviction can change.
So the girlfriend remains underage, but the boy becomes an adult.
Correct.
So it becomes statutory rape?
What most people would consider statutory rape, or what used to be called statutory rape, yes.
So I understand that this is a sex offense which can result in prison time here in Oregon, but right across the Columbia River, it's consensual sex between an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. So the laws are confusing.
I believe that laws are being looked at in Oregon regarding the age differences. So that's something to think about.
So an 18-year-old having sex with an underage youth or a 40-year-old having sex with an underage youth. Now, is treatment the same?
The treatment for those people will be different. Let's look at this. So we've looked at the continuum of sexual offending. You can have that with the difference in age. Someone turns 18, their girlfriend was 16, they're convicted. We also have people who are addicted to pornography, and they get themselves looking at child pornography. That is a sexual offense. You have people who will expose themselves in public, and there's a lot of different reasons people may do that. You've got people who are incest abusers. That's a large number. Most sexual offenses are committed by people known to the victim and or the family.
Say that again.
Most sexual offenses are committed by someone known to the victim or the family. When you've got a stranger-to-stranger offense, which does happen, that is, when you look at the continuum, that is the smallest percent of sexual offenses that will occur, is a stranger-to-stranger. It's more difficult to commit, may require more planning. So we've got a gamut. And in treatment, what is extremely important is to do a assessment, an evaluation of every client who comes into the practice, and then you put them into the proper level of treatment. So someone in that age group of where they're 18, they're going to be in a group of others who have that same type of offense, and they will receive treatment based on their risk level. When you've got a stranger to stranger or a violent rape, those people should not be in the same group. It's pretty traumatizing to some of the young kids if they're put in that. And then those other people, the ones on the other end of the continuum who have definitely a higher risk level for recidivism per the research, it's still low relative to other crimes, but they need intensive treatment. There's biofeedback machines that are used to work with them. Their treatment's going to take longer. But one thing to keep in mind that's common across the board is their decision-making is what needs to be looked at. Because even if you say, oh, well, your girlfriend was 16 and then you turned 18, some of them don't realize that's a crime, but some of them do. So it's like, well, why did you break the law? What caused you to go over and take the risk of breaking the law? And that's the primary thing that we look at in that age group. By the time you get to the other end of the continuum, you've got some ingrained addictions. You've got some brain wiring of arousal, but that can be unwired for most sexual offenders or people who've sexually offended. One, if they want to do treatment. And two, if they work really hard, it takes hard work. Three, if they get their families involved, that helps a huge, huge amount. And we have worked with churches, if they're allowed to go into church, their church elders know, if they're attending school, their school knows, other neighbors may know, again, depending on the risk level and if they are having proximity or nearness to kids, then those people around them, we will ask to be involved in helping them stick with their probation or parole conditions.
Do you find that most people with sex abuse convictions want to change their behaviors?
Yes, most do. And there are some who, if you set up the therapeutic relationship properly, you can get some to say, I can't imagine my life without this addiction. I can't imagine my life without this offending because that was my coping mechanism. So they need to learn a new coping mechanism and realize that here's something else that's going to replace what you found. Wasn't drugs, wasn't alcohol. It was acting out inappropriately in a sexual manner. The model of sex offender treatment is based very closely to the model of alcohol and drug treatment. The type of treatment that research shows is most effective is called cognitive behavioral therapy. That means cognitive thinking that will result in certain behaviors. Now, what happens, though, is that thinking, just like someone can get addicted to an alcohol or a drug, and there's actual physical changes in the brain that can happen, that happens with sexual offending. So one initially starts with the thinking and then can get addicted to an arousal to a certain type of offending. And that may be offending a child in the family, let's say. And that arousal there needs to be using biofeedback and something called arousal reconditioning, which is a very complex type of treatment that needs training. But you unwire that physical arousal because most of them don't want to keep doing this. Now, and that goes along with the connection to the violence, because there's two different, when you look at child molesters, and then we'll talk about pedophiles, but child molesters, there's two different types. There's those who have a preferential type of offending and those who are more on a situational type of offending or opportunistic. The situational or opportunistic type of offending is the child happens to be there. Okay. The preferential is more they prefer children as a partner. That doesn't mean they won't have adult relationships, but when you have someone who has a preference for children, arousal reconditioning may work for them, but if you have it's a mental health diagnosis of pedophilia, they may say, I am attracted to children, I don't want to offend them, but I can't overcome this attraction. And if they cannot overcome it with arousal reconditioning, they have the pedophilia diagnosis, then they need to learn how to manage those impulses. And treatment will be very intensive and give them many tools to manage those impulses, just like someone who's trying to quit the alcohol. It's a lifelong recovery. And with any treatment, they need to want to change. And it can be done, but they need to commit to a lifelong recovery program.
And if you just tuned in, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. With me is Janine Mano, a licensed professional counselor and a certified clinical sex offender therapist. Janine, very complex, very difficult issue. So the Jerry Sanduskys and the issues with the Catholic priests, what type of abuse are we talking about?
Well, there would need to be an assessment to figure out exactly where they lie on the continuum, if they are child molesters or if they're pedophiles, as I discussed, the differences in the two. But one thing that I think may perpetuate, and this is just my thinking that may perpetuate that, is they are working in a closed system. Everything is kept secret. The more things are kept secret, the more that offending can grow. And that's why I say with whole systems, with getting the communities involved around that person who's committed an offense, puts things out in the open, and things are exposed for them, they feel sometimes such relief to be able to say, boy, here's what I've done. Here's my history of offending. That's something to keep in mind. Some of these people, it may be their first time offense. For others, they may have been offending for years and all of a sudden they got caught. In treatment, they are required to give us their full sexual history from birth to the day they're sitting with a polygrapher. But they are protected by law to not have to self-incriminate. We're not there to tell us every victim you've had, because who's going to say that? Who's going to do that? In order to get the information we need, they still do that polygraph, but they do not give names. If they give a name and that person is still a minor, then we need to report that. But by knowing, say, that they've been offending for many, many years, and we are involved with their support networks, we're involved with their community, we can say, we know this person has a history of offending, say, people he's met in a church. Therefore, that person should probably not be going to a church, or if they are going to go, it needs to be not in a general mass, it needs to be in an adult-only mass, so to speak. But by everybody knowing that, then they know, okay, we're going to support you and not getting yourself in a risky situation. That's like saying, okay, we know you have an alcohol problem. Don't go to bars. Same thing here. We know that you've had a problem for the past so many years being attracted to this type of person in this environment. You're not going to go there anymore.
And Janine, talking about secrets, talking about getting the community involved, the churches involved, talking about disclosure. You recently had an incident with your clinic. After harsh criticism from the Selwood neighbors, you moved your clinic out of the neighborhood. The neighbors claimed that you kept your clinic a secret. Your building was unmarked. It was close to a boys and girls club, a Montessori school, who claimed they had no idea. A clinic that was treating persons convicted of a sex offense was in their community. Talk about that.
I really think that was a lost opportunity to get a community involved in our treatment. And there were efforts from the start of us trying to get the community involved. But our landlord, property owners, as they said, they knew that we were there. They're members of the Business Alliance. We provided information to them and said, you know, we'd like to meet with the Business Alliance and start getting the word out what we do and how we can work with your community. But because I think there was so much fear to begin with, that there was a fear that there was going to be in the Business Alliance that maybe things needed to be presented a certain way, so I was not invited to go and do that myself. We did not know about the Montessori school prior to moving in, and we definitely had said we couldn't be around school. So when we learned about that, actually 2 months before the Selwood neighbors came to me, I had proposed to the property owner that, you know, it's looking like this isn't the best fit. So I think let's all sit down and talk about moving to fill everyone's needs. We need a safe environment to treat our clients. You need to rent your building and the community's not feeling safe. My employees and clients were no longer safe. And we had camera crews walking into our counseling office and blocking our exit, a camera crew, I should say, and we had to get police escorts to get out. And that was after we said we were going to move. Mm-hmm. Oh, and as far as disclosure, this is a very complex issue. When you talk about notifying communities about your clinic, we as therapists have patient privacy laws. We cannot talk about our clients to anyone unless they sign releases and say, yes, you can.
But can you say that you're treating people who have been convicted of sex crimes?
That's one of those things where what the laws say is that if you are asked what you do, then yes, go ahead and provide a reasonable explanation of what you do. Because of the stigma around what we do, and because clients don't like to walk into a counseling office that's stated counseling, I've always kept our buildings without the word counseling on the front of the building.
But you were there a whole year.
We have a right as a business to establish our business. We didn't break any laws, and we really did do our due diligence in what we believed was the due diligence we did with all the other offices we'd been in and never had a problem. We had been in other offices for 5 years. People knew who we were. A licensed professional counselor, any treatment provider needs to have that a balance between who do you tell, why are you telling them, and then how do you get the information out.
And working with Multnomah County and Clackamas County, were there any requirements from the county about disclosure to the neighborhood?
No, there isn't. Their primary concern and our primary concern is that they go to treatment in a safe place, obviously, and that they can go to treatment without breaking their parole and probation conditions. And, you know, I don't want to speak for the counties. What I've done now, I'm making the calls directly and saying, let me deliver this message, nobody else.
In your new location.
Yeah, in the new location. But what I'm going to focus on is how they can get involved from a community standpoint. It's a practice that treats people who have been convicted of a sexual offense as well as provides community training on an ongoing basis. And we've always provided that.
Again, Janine, very complex, very difficult issue. And we don't want to forget the victims. With every sex crime, there is a victim or victims. Talk about the victims.
The victims are a very important piece. And in every treatment program, there's a component called the victim clarification and victim empathy component. And this is important for those who are going to go through treatment to remember. There's two questions victims will always ask. Why me? And why did they do what they did? Those two questions need to be able to be answered by the person who's committed the offense, because when they can answer that question, then they will be able to understand their offense cycle and come up with a prevention plan to reoffend again. We have victims involved in the treatment, but only if they want to be, and sometimes they never want to be involved or see the person again. And that could be one's own children, and that is completely honored. And part of the treatment is coming to terms with that.
Janine, what are some of the challenges for people coming out of jail and prison who have been convicted of a sex offense?
One of the things that I hear from clients, and I know that it is such a challenge, and this is people who receive parole or probation conditions that say that they are not to be anywhere in proximity contact, in nearness of where minors congregate. They are not to have direct contact with minors. Now, here's the thing. When one is incarcerated, from what I understand, many of them can see their families and children while they're there.
During visitation?
Yes. When they are released, and if they have the conditions, the standard conditions that most people get who've been convicted of a sexual offense, they can't move back home because they have kids. And they say, wait a minute, I was talking to them just the other day in prison. Now what? What do I tell my kids? Well, you can't even tell your kids anything. And you cannot send messages to them through a third party. This is why we believe that getting information to those people prior to sentencing to say, here's what you need to be prepared for. And there are steps you can begin to take now so that you can, if it's safe, move back in with your family, have a place to live, be reunited with your kids, if it's safe. I want to really highlight that.
And you're talking about before sentencing?
Before they get their probation or parole, or right at the time they get it, is when I believe that they should be notified. Here's what's going to happen. You're not going to be allowed to be around kids. There are some who, depending on their lawyer, may get something that says, okay, yes, you are allowed to be around your siblings, but that's very rare.
And Janine, you feel there are steps that people convicted of a sex offense and their families can take during and after incarceration?
There are, and I've talked with some of the probation and parole officers about this, and they're in agreement. Right away, some of the things that they can do is if we can get word to the DA's office and attorneys, maybe the public defense organizations, that here's a resource for the families and those who are convicted that they can get involved in right now in preparation for reentry. One of the first things would be that the families, friends, other support networks can go through a training right away to learn what is the treatment for this type of offense. What are safety plans? We are always developing safety plans that are signed by the client, the therapist, the parole or probation officer. The parents of the children need to give permission if there is going to be contact with those kids. I've had 30 people sign a safety plan so that every single parent was informed when an uncle was coming out and he wanted to be able to continue to attend some of the family functions. Well, he wasn't going to be able to unless every single person was notified.
And that's in one family for one person.
Correct.
Wow.
And so they can start in understanding that process. And then the person who's convicted themselves, there's two really important steps that they can begin. One is to prepare for that full sexual history polygraph in a way where they feel they can disclose everything without self-incriminating so that we can truly understand the entire scope of their offending.
And when do they do that?
Typically, we want them to do that within the first 3, if possible, to 6 months within treatment. Getting someone comfortable with disclosing everything takes a little bit of time. Some are ready to go, but others, there's a lot of fear also. it's part of the treatment process, but they can actually start. Imagine having to talk about every single partner you've had in your life. It takes time to think that through, and there's forums we have. I should say the problem with that I hear, though, from people in prison is they don't want that information to be known or seen because they can get a lot of harassment or beat up and who knows what if their crime is known. So, but there's ways that perhaps that information can be brought during a visitation, worked on, and given back to the family member to hold until the next visitation. There's assignments they can get started on right away prior to entering treatment that will give them sort of the base. What we really think would be helpful is close to either being released from prison or right when being put on probation, they can begin what's called an intake assessment. It's called a brief psychosexual evaluation where we give them lots of tests to see, do they have any mental health disorders? Where are their arousal levels? Where is their sexual interest? And begin to work on a treatment plan.
And what kind of treatment are they getting in prison?
There used to be some, but I think the funding got cut and there's not a lot available. And what we want them to know is hold on to that paperwork if you can, although sometimes they will throw it away or destroy it again for fear of repercussion by other inmates. Hold on to that. That's going to help you when you come into treatment here. And we're going to give you credit for that.
And Janine, how could someone inside, if they want to get in touch with you, give your phone number, please?
Our phone number is 503-657-0072.
Janine Mano, any last thoughts or words?
I think I just want to really encourage communities to know that there are people who have been convicted of sexual offenders who are in our communities. They could be living next door. They could be within your churches. And the more that you educate yourself about them, then the more that safety can increase. And that's why we make a point to provide trainings to people in the community in order to increase their information.
You have been listening to KBOO Portland. I want to thank my guest, Janine Mano. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Thank you to our engineer, Danielle. Good night.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's about 7:01 p.m., Monday, April 29th, 2013. And up next is KBOO's broadcast of Hard Knock Radio. Stay tuned.
Coming up Tuesday, April 30th at 6 p.m. will be the fourth episode in Tune In, Turn On, Remember, 45 Great Years of KBOO Community Radio. My guest this week will be Shahid Hamid, longtime programmer here at KBOO, and we're going to remember the Master Blaster George Page. Join us for 60 minutes of great remembrance right here on Tune In, Turn On, Remember, 45 years of great KBOO community radio. That's Tuesday, April 30th at 6 p.m. only on KBOO.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
It's history. Never been done before.
What up, everybody? Welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we talk about the police and the FBI visiting activists who are getting ready for the May Day celebrations in Seattle. Later on, we talk with the folks out of Atlanta about the Funk Jazz Cafe, the brand new documentary that's going to be filming in Oakland this Tuesday. All that and more coming up after the afternoon headlines.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Sunday was Workers' Memorial Day, an annual day intended to reflect on preventable deaths and injuries due to a failure to implement suitable workplace safeguards. While the day is primarily recognized in Canada and the United States, this year there was a heavy focus on the unfolding tragedy in Bangladesh. On Saturday, 23 workers were pulled out of the ruins of a Bangladeshi garment factory that collapsed early last week. An estimated 900 people are still missing, with at least 340 confirmed deaths. The collapse has once again put an international spotlight on the poor working conditions and inefficient building standards in the South Asian country. According to Al Jazeera, police have arrested two engineers who approved the building construction and two owners of New Wave Apparels Limited. Bangladeshi officials told the news agency that the top three floors of the eight-story building were constructed illegally. Workers had protested going to work in the days leading up to the collapse due to cracks appearing in the walls of the factory complex. However, management ordered workers to enter the building and work or else lose wages. The collapse has also brought attention to the reluctance of Western corporations that do business in Bangladesh to enforce safety standards on contractors. In 2011, the National Garment Workers Federation in Bangladesh presented a proposal to retailers that would have helped improve safety standards. According to the Associated Press, those companies rejected the proposals and instead pledged to self-audit. Among the companies rejecting the proposal were H&M, Walmart, and Gap. Since that 2011 proposal was first rejected, incidents at Bangladesh's garment factories have not declined. In November of 2012, a factory fire took the lives of 112 workers. An investigation into that fire revealed that management had locked the doors so workers couldn't leave and thereby trapped the workers in the inferno. It had echoes of the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City, which led to reforms in safety standards in the United States. In contrast,